We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your hosts, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 337. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. It's either the fact that it's 6 o'clock in the morning or the fact that it was a hell of a weekend for me, for you, for the Yankees, for Bronx Pinstripes. That was a fun one, Scott.
It was a fun one. I didn't even go on Saturday like you did, but I had a bunch of family stuff happening, and I'm still struggling from Friday night, to tell you the damn truth. Like, yesterday was a solid day two hangover. My voice was jacked up still. When LeMahieu hit a home run, I think I lost my mind. Someone tweeted me that they just saw me pop a blood vessel. You know, there was a bunch of very good things that happened over the weekend. Unfortunately, Sunday, you know, clouded it a little bit, but I'm not letting that bring me down. I'm looking at lots of really good things that did happen this weekend.
You go into a series against the Red Sox. We thought it was going to be a 4-gamer, ended up being a 3-gamer, and you say take 2 out of 3. I know people are saying, oh, if you had swept the Red Sox, that buries them in the American League East. But the reality is that doesn't bury. If they swept them, wouldn't have buried them in the American League East. So 2 out of 3, you take care of business. You have won the majority of the games against them. You've been at home for all of the games so far. I don't know. Good stuff, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you look down and we all had magic balls and we said, in over the winter that the Yankees would start off 4-1 against the Red Sox, I think every single one of us would take that all day long. I feel like we have to say all these things right now because they lost last night. Like, that's the only reason we have to say any of this stuff, because the overwhelming play for the majority of the weekend, besides the seventh inning right field debacle, you know, it was positive. It was good. It was good.
Yeah, of course. When you lose the last game of a series when you're going for a sweep,
it's in the manner, the fashion that they lost it.
And especially because they mounted a little bit of a rally late in that game with that, it was just downpouring in the umpires. I feel like, is that a new trend in baseball, at least for the Yankees? Let's just play through a monsoon.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it seemed like they had the right idea considering it was pretty short. But yeah, I mean, that rally was definitely helped by the fact that that they couldn't grip the ball.
Right.
It was pretty tough to grip that ball. It was very obvious.
But the reason I say it would not have clinched anything in the American League East, I mean, that's obvious. We're sitting here at the beginning of June. But because of that rainout on Thursday night, and I thought maybe we'd get a doubleheader at some point this weekend, or maybe even a Monday game, because last time I checked, the Red Sox are also off. The Yankees are off. So mutual off day, you could play it today as we're talking on Monday. But no, they rescheduled to August 3rd, doubleheader in the Bronx. That means from July 25th to August 4th, in 11 days, they're going to play 8 times.
That's
so you're playing a 7-game playoff series plus a little extra in a matter of a week and a half. So that is when the American League East could very well be decided. Now you might be saying, oh, hey, for 8 games, you split 4-4. That's probably what's going to happen. And to that I say, beautiful. Split those games, because the Red Sox are not going to come back from an 8.5 deficit by splitting games with the Yankees. So, but that is really going to be Armageddon, I think, in the middle of summer.
You know, it's funny because the fact that the Yankees have played, how many times have we played the Reds, the Orioles already? 19
12.
Times. We've played them 11, 12
11
times.
11 or 12, yeah.
The Red Sox haven't played them as much, you know, and I think that when we're looking at later in the season as well, it's again going to come down to a lot of this inner division play and how the teams are taking care of their opponents. And when the season gets tougher for the Yankees, are the Red Sox going to be, you know, mowing down the Orioles and the Blue Jays? And we're going to start seeing, you know, those games come back to us. So, you know, by no means am I saying that the Red Sox are out of it, because they're not. They're just not. They started off terrible. They still have weapons. They still have a potent offense. They still have, you know, very good top line starting pitching. So, you know, they're going to go on a run at some point, and it's probably going to be feeding on some of these American League East teams.
And the Yankees, as much as they've played the Orioles, haven't played the Blue Jays yet.
Right.
They're about to play them for the first time, so. If they can take care of the Blue Jays, there's another handful of games, 19 games against a division opponent that's going to help decide the division. Yeah, and the Red Sox, I know they haven't played Baltimore as much, but they have not taken care of Baltimore so far.
Right. No, I know, but it could be a similar storyline to what we saw last year in the sense that, you know, I think everybody more or less does expect for the Yankees and the Red Sox to split relatively. It'll be close, you know, yeah. So that's when you're looking at, you know, unless it's, you know, last game of the series or last series of the year type thing, and it boils down to those two teams and they're playing each other, it's probably going to boil down to other series that are going to be the deciding factor. And then when you look at who's in the American League, you're looking at the Orioles, you're looking at the Blue Jays, and the fact that the Yankees have already played the Orioles, you know, a baker's dozen times, that the Red Sox still have a lot of those games.
Let's talk about the Friday night event. Thank you to everybody who came out. This was a blast. We called for people to show up and get rowdy, and that's exactly what happened. Friday night, first game, thought it was going to be second, first game of a weekend series against the Red Sox in summer. That was a lot of fun.
It was a ton of fun, man. It was probably a little too much fun. It was a very good time. Just met a whole bunch of people, saw a lot of familiar faces, which is awesome. That's, you know, some of my favorite things, I think, is going and when we're transferring the tickets, because you and I do, we do the seating, we transfer the tickets, so we kind of see the names from all these events too, and you know, I recognize a lot of them. So it's always good to see those guys again at the game, and then meeting new people. Yeah, man, it's just so much fun. I love it. This is probably my favorite part of being a Yankee fan, is going out and meeting more Yankee fans in this group, and the fact that like everybody's hanging out with each other, and you know, we went out to the bars afterwards with some of the people, and beforehand obviously at the dugout. It's just an overall encompassing good time, and when you have a good game and there's some offense, because it definitely helps, there's no doubt about it. When the Yankees are playing,
we've been to some of those games that don't go our way. It's a little different.
It's definitely different. But when you have a game where there's some offense happening, and there's some good vibes going on, and good things happening on the field as well, and the Yankees are playing the Red Sox, like it's a hell of an atmosphere. It really is. And you know, you're high-fiving every single person around you, like people up in rows ahead of you, rows behind you. People flying up and down the aisles, like it's just fun.
Yeah, JJ throwing things at me. yeah, we had, and you know what I noticed on Saturday? I saw a couple people from the event that went out on Saturday too. So yeah. A lot of people had the same idea. Let's just make a weekend of it.
Yeah, damn right. It's a good idea.
It was. It's the next one's coming up very quickly, June 22nd against Houston. They'll be here before you know it. So.
I'm pretty
get ready, Scott.
I gotta look at the calendar again because I'm pretty sure I have to order T-shirts. Like, I think we're gonna have a T-shirt cut off at the end of this week. I think that's what's happening. So, yeah, June 22nd is the Houston series or the Houston game. That's a 7 o'clock game, a night game. And yeah, go get those tickets. I know we have over 100 sold. We sold a bunch this weekend as well. I think when people saw the good time that we were having on Saturday, they went and grabbed some tickets. It's a good deal. What is it? $67, I think it is. $64, $65, something like that.
I know the Red Sox one was a little bit more expensive because it's a premium.
It's a premium game
rivalry.
They charge us more.
Charges us more, but it's going to be a good deal no matter what. Even if it's a Red Sox game, or if it's an Astros game, or if it's, I know they're playing the Rockies in July 20th. Really, though, you're paying for to go to a game with like 200 of your closest friends, because that's what it's like. Yeah. You're going in a mob of Yankees fans. I know the whole stadium's filled with Yankee fans, but we really feel it started over as these events are building, as they're going. This is now into the third year that we're doing them. It really feels like you have that camaraderie with these people. Now seen games with some of these people five times.
Yeah.
So, you know, that builds, and you kind of, like you said, high-fiving every time there's a home run or a big strikeout, big moment in the game. People are loud. People are booing the Red Sox. People are cheering the Yankees. So, yeah, a ton of fun. That's really what you're paying for. You're paying for the atmosphere, the camaraderie of the event.
Yeah, I mean, and it's cheaper than getting a ticket retail as well. So, I mean, usually. Doesn't hurt the fact. But then a couple more things. We got June 29th, the watch party
in Tavern in 29.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you guys, I know a couple people actually tweeted me over the weekend that they want to come. So, you know, it's going to be, we're not selling tickets for this or anything, but we do want to get a sort of an accurate head count so we can give the bar a heads up. They're going to give us a space to watch the game. So join the Facebook group. Just mark that you're going, or tweet me. I know some people said, one person said they don't have Facebook, so up here, I'm gonna remember that.
Yeah, I know. I've gotten a couple of questions asking about if there's still tickets available. There's no tickets. You just this is a show up thing. It's just a watch party at a bar, but. If you can, RSVP, that'd be cool, just so we can give them a head count. And then July 6th, we're doing the invasion at Tampa. I met a bunch of people from Tampa this weekend, which was fun. They were up here for the game. And so now I think we got more tickets, more people going, and they're going to be spreading the word. Look, we have over 200. We have 200 tickets reserved for Tampa. We've had these events up in New York, so I haven't really been pushing this Tampa thing as hard yet. We got to start pushing it because I need to sell some of these tickets. So if you're in Tampa and you're or in the surrounding area or in Florida, just want to get in a freaking car and go and have a good time, you know, get these tickets because it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be invading the trap. 200 tickets again. I think we're
that
probably
means there's going to be 212 people in that stadium. Right. With 200 in your section and 12 other people scattered around
the stadium. We're sitting right by the Yankees bullpen, which is down the line. So they're good seats. And hopefully we can get some chatter with those guys. And then
and you know what?
Yeah,
I mean, Tampa, we were talking about the Red Sox, but Tampa's 2.5 out. So that's...
Tampa's the right now the immediate threat. Yeah, they're a good team. So there's no doubt about it. And then July 20th is the Colorado game that Andrew was talking about.
Nice. So the Yankees had their best May. They finished May 20-7. That's their best May since 1998, if you can believe it or not. I mean, we think back to last year in the May that they had when they went on that run. And it seemed like they couldn't lose a game at the end of April and in May. And turns out this May was better than last year with all these replacements, without Judge, without Stanton, without Andujar, without Severino. 20-7 plus 42 run differential.
It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. Like, what are we doing here? How is this team putting up the same numbers that these guys, you know, that this was the lineup of superstars that were playing well at that time? How does this even happen? Well, the fact that Cashman and his team went out and found all this depth and identified talent that was relatively, you know, unseen, I guess, or you know, not hitting its stride as Gio Urshela. I don't know how else to explain Gio Urshela other than the fact that he's now hitting his stride. He's understanding how to hit better than he's ever done it before, because nothing he's put on paper this year is matched what he's done in his career. So look, they're playing out of their minds.
And you know what you're also
starting
to get? Yeah. I heard Buster Olney on the ESPN broadcast last night talking about how Brian Cashman always wanted to trade for Gio Urshela.
I heard that last night too.
So now you're starting to get the narrative. Like, there's some mole in the Yankees system that's like, oh no, Brian Cashman's been on Gio Urshela for 10 years. He's known about him. When in reality, no. He didn't know about him. He just needed a backup infielder, and it turned out Gio Urshela turned into the next friggin' all-star.
I mean, I like that story. I think it's a good story. I think he probably was on him. See, this is the thing. I'm giving Cashman more credit than ever. I think the credit runs deep. I think that by you dismissing a report like that, Buster Olney has deep roots in the New York Yankees.
But I've also seen reports that say, of course, we didn't expect Gio Urshela to do this.
I kind of trust Buster Olney. I mean, he knows a lot of people in the organization. He used to write about the Yankees back in the day.
He's a Vermont boy.
Look, he's a guy who can get information, can get some intel. He's probably the only person I trust on the ESPN broadcast, to tell you the truth. The fact that he is saying this, and look, I can't dismiss anything from Brian Cashman. If someone thinks that Brian Cashman probably was on Gio Urshela 3 years ago, I'm probably like, okay, maybe, probably, because it's Brian Cashman.
Whatever it is, it's worked out, and that's good. 9 series wins in a row. And sort of comparing it to last year, though, the cliche goes, where are you on June 1st? Don't overreact to April baseball games. May is when the weather heats up, the team starts to figure it out. Where are you as a team on June 1st? Where they are is pretty much the same place they were last year. Last year, they were 37-18 on June 2nd. That's the series closest to June 1st. And then this year on June 2nd, after June 2nd, 38-20. So 2 more losses, 1 more win. It's essentially the same exact spot they were last year, except the only difference is last year they were fully healthy in June, and we thought just going to keep going on the rise, and it turned out they maybe plateaued in June and then started to fall a little bit. This year, I think most fans think, and I think you and I think, this team is going to get better because they're going to start adding back their regulars into the lineup.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at who's playing out there and then who's coming back, you got to, you know, at some point assume that they are going to improve or at least keep up this pace, because the guys that are playing now, and that's to say that they're going to improve, is it would almost be a knock to the guys and what they're doing now. Like, there's really, they're doing everything that these guys would normally do. I mean, that's what's crazy about it. It's,
but there's a fear the current guys, Urshela. I hate just using Urshela, but there's a lot of contribution, and we're starting to see it with Herman, where he's starting to fall a little bit.
Yeah.
So this is where getting guys back healthy, if you can get Severino back into that rotation, because everyone's saying the comparisons between Herman in the first 2 months of the season this year to Severino in the first 2 months of the season last year, same guy, same pitcher. And right. That is true. The numbers are very similar. But now we're starting to see Herman, two bad starts in a row, and then a third start thrown in there that really wasn't that great. I have some numbers on him, but 3 2/3 innings over the weekend, basically just an opener. We're starting to see him hit a wall. If they can get Severino back, Paxton just came back, Sabathia just came back, that will ensure the rotation doesn't take a hit if Herman takes a hit. Or if you can get Stanton back and you can get Judge back, that can ensure that the offense is not going to take a hit if Urshela does stop hitting, which, let's be all honest, could happen.
Well, I think that those thoughts and those people looking at that, the glass half empty in the sense that he's going to stop hitting, is slowing down and being more quiet, because
no one thought he would still be hitting on June 2nd.
He's continuing to do it now. And it's not just him. I mean, there's other guys in this lineup who, you know, have been hitting at a clip. I mean, look at the production from Clint Frazier at the plate. I mean, the guy's got an unbelievable production.
The plate.
Now, yeah, I have to just make this distinction now. But could we save a few runs if we had Aaron Judge in right field? You're goddamn right we could. You're absolutely right we could.
It would have been a closer game last night, that's for sure.
Yeah, so you're looking at different areas where this team has excelled, and probably everything has gone as well as it could go with these guys.
Estrada's given him so much off the bench. Cameron Maben has given him a lot off the bench.
Yeah.
Luke Voit has, for the most part, been the productive player we saw at the end of last year. He's taken that production into this year. I know he's had a couple slumps, but for the most part, he's been really good. I mean, LeMahieu, I think we all
will continue. Yeah.
We all knew LeMahieu was a good player. I don't think any of us expected LeMahieu to be their best player, which I think objectively, he has been their best player all around, start to finish so far.
Yeah, when you're looking at consistency and, like, you know, very start to now, and the fact that he plays, you know, practically a Gold Glove infield anywhere he plays. I mean, the guy is so good on the infield. I mean, he's playing right field as well right now.
he's got to play the first 100 feet of right
field. I mean, that's not even a freaking joke. He's been doing that. Even the last, or the I forget what game that was when Frazier was in right, when he went out and made another.
I think it was a Kansas City game.
It was a Kansas City game, yeah. And then Frazier had to make the last minute, like, weird adjustment catch to it. But he was, it's just wild the what's happening there. But yeah, LeMay, he was definitely, I think, been that guy. But yeah, we expected that. At least I expected that. I expected big time production from DJ LeMahieu.
He's at 6 home runs now. He got his 6 just for you on Friday night.
He got, I mean, first of all, that was amazing. It was, I literally lost my shit when he hit that home run. He's become one of my favorite players just because I love everything he's doing. And the fact that he's one of my predictions just makes it better. So I have something invested in this now. And I want
you're spiteful, just like me.
I just want to throw it in your face. That's the only thing I want.
That's fair enough. That's the whole point of being a fan. All the couple things you're right about, because let's ignore the 1,000 things we're wrong about and just focus on the things we're right about, and throw them in each other's face.
I've rallied a squad on Twitter too. I'm going to acknowledge them. I got a DJ LeMahieu 20 home run squad out there that is looking for these home runs, that wants to throw it in your face too. So there's people with pitchforks ready to go.
Because I can't believe you haven't started a I hate DJ LeMahieu narrative yet. You did it with me and Ronald Torres, even though I never hated Ronald Torres.
No, but you actually hated Ronald Torres.
I'm surprised you haven't started the Andrew hates DJ LeMahieu narrative.
No, because I don't think you actually hate DJ LeMahieu, but
I believe... I love DJ LeMahieu.
I know. I think you actually... I think you have a some kind of like a discrimination against short people, and Ronald Torres was one. You didn't like the mole on his face. You didn't like the way he looked. You didn't like the way he tried to steal Aaron Judge's spotlight. No. You didn't like him. So, that was just a plain fact.
He stole Carlos Beltran's mole.
Well, there you go. Now you're mocking the moles of these men. Okay, multiple men.
Judge called LeMahieu the sale killer after the game. Mm-hmm. So obviously he had the big night off sale, RBI double, solo home run. He was most of the offense. He made a really nice play in the field on Nunez, who then later made a stupid base running play. Just classic Nunez. Shocking. Helmet falling off all weekend. Yeah. Can he get a chin strap at some, like, what's going on with him?
Yo, here's what I'm scared about though. Is Gleyber becoming the new Nunez on the base path? Because I think he is.
Well, Gleyber, yeah, we've talked about this. Gleyber is a terrible base runner.
Right, but he's definitely reminded me of Nunez in the sense where he just makes boneheaded stuff. Like, what are you doing? I mean, it's there. it's starting to build. Nunez had, I felt like, did it. And the fact that his helmet would fly off would make it look just worse. So yeah. I'm glad that Gleyber has his helmet staying on.
Well, I think that's the face protector on Glaber's helmet, I think, helps to keep it on.
Yeah. Does Nunez not have that? It's become a trend now in the league.
Yeah. He needs more aerodynamics to get the helmet off. The Yankees didn't really hit Sale very hard. He actually struck out 10 guys over six innings, but now he's 1-7 on the season, which is pretty crazy. Win and loss records, I know, are not as popular to talk about, but seven losses with only one win. It will be his worst win-loss record of the year unless things drastically change. He went 11-14 in 2013. He's just not a pitcher you think is going to go 1-7 or even 500 for that matter. So it's just more of the fact that something doesn't seem quite right with the Red Sox. Like, your number one pitcher is out there 1-7. You're mostly healthy for the whole season. I know they've had some guys banged up, but the large part of their team, I mean, can't compare their injuries to the Yankees by any means, but they're a game over 500. And I don't know. Something just doesn't seem right outsider looking into the Red Sox.
Yeah, no, I mean, they are healthy. I think they're healthy. They have, some fresh new blood at first base now too. And they got a little momentum with some young guys. And you can't explain it. Last year they played unbelievable. I still look at what happened last year and think that they played the perfect season and things went exactly according to plan, the way that it needed to go for them to be the standing at the end. And I just don't think those things are happening this year to the same effect. So there is an element of things have to go right in baseball, and I think everything legitimately went right for them last year, and you're not seeing the same, good vibes around that team and good feeling. But again, it's June, that shit can change very quickly. Like you could stop on a dime, and all of a sudden they're playing well, and the entire team is playing well, and all of a sudden they wing off 10 straight. Because I do expect that to happen at some point.
My dad texted me and he said the difference between the Red Sox this year and last year is last year in the ninth inning on Saturday, JD Martinez hits a double up the gap off Chapman and it's a tie game. And this year he grounds into a double play.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the big overwhelming things for them as well is they always have that feeling in the back of their head that if their starters don't go deep into a game, they're in big trouble. And now they have to press to score more runs because they know how dog shit the back of their bullpen is just not good. And when you look up and down it, they have some guys who are probably
overperforming. I mean, the names aren't good. Their bullpen's been okay, though. Their bullpen has been more productive than their starting pitching.
But they expect those starting pitchers, when healthy, they still believe in Chris Sale.
They're going to have to lean on their rotation.
Yes.
Sale, Porcello, Price.
They've blown a lot of games.
Evaldi, if he's out there.
They've blown, I think, Evaldi's probably going to slot into the bullpen. But they have a lot of games that are lost because of the bullpen as well. So, I don't expect that bullpen to get any better unless they're going out and making a move. But they've pretty much drawn a line in the sand with what they're going to spend. So I'd be surprised if they went out and got another piece unless it was something that they gave up to they're giving up something to get something in return. But they just their system is relatively shallow at this point as well. So it's tough for them to make a move unless they spend money. And they already said, I'm not spending money. Kimbrel's still sitting out there. They could have, one of the better closers in baseball if they wanted to, but they choose not to.
Yeah, they don't even seem linked to him.
No.
All the teams that are talked about, Kimbrel, I've heard the Twins.
Not that means jack shit, but no. Yeah.
Right, they could swoop in at the last minute. Hap went five innings Friday. He gave up just a home run to Devers. So now his updated stats when he's not facing the Baltimore Orioles, 46 innings, 38 hits, 19 earned runs, has a 3.72 ERA, 8 home runs allowed. I don't know. He's pitching good enough against non-Baltimore Orioles. Five innings, one run, I'll take it. Especially with a 2 days off prior and a rested bullpen.
I'm not going to lie, when we were at that game, it's very hard to follow exactly what's happening just because there's so much going on in the stands as well. And when I saw that he only pitched five innings, I was very surprised because I thought he went way deeper than that. But, you know, I think I was probably much deeper than five innings on the beer count that I was at that point. So
you went deeper on beer than Hap went in the game.
Yeah. So I think that contributed. But over his last two starts, you know, ever since we saw yet another blow up, we've seen pretty good Hap, I think. I think he's been good. I think when you're going five innings, letting up that, you know, the one home run to Devers, you want that.
Did you see the pitch he hit it on? It was a pitch at the letters, like legitimately 6 inches above the zone.
Yeah, Devers hit another pitch last night that Sessa threw that was looked like a slider or some kind of a cutter down and away. That was a really, really good pitch that I couldn't believe he hit and slapped it into left field. So Devers has become, you know, or becoming, I guess, more of a guy that can go outside the strike zone and chase the ball and put it in play. So that's dangerous.
His fastball, Hap's fastball sinker mix was 33% fastball, 45% sinkers. It's the same trend that we saw early in that April game against Boston, too, where he threw more sinkers. So that's obviously a game plan going in against the Red Sox, and it's seeming to work out. He has never thrown his sinker this much when you look at any of his other games. He's usually relying on his fastball. And the last couple games, he's been relying on his fastball just like he always has. So he's not really changing his overall approach into a game. It's just for whatever reason, the Orioles seem to crush him. We really can't figure it out. Maybe it's just one of those weird things we're going to look back on at the end of the season. And if he's pitching to a 3.7 ERA against everyone not named Baltimore, okay. That's pretty much the Hap we signed up for.
I fully expect the next time he faces Baltimore in this season, with some time in between and him figuring his shit out, that he's going to dominate them. That's what I expect. I truly believe it's a guy that just wasn't able to command his fastball early in the season, and they played them a lot, and it was just a matter of circumstance, and that's what happened, and that's why they hit him. That's where I'm at. That's my final thought.
I don't know if you can have any other takeaway other than that.
Yeah, he just couldn't locate the fastball, and you know, when that happens, it's a problem for major league hitters, so, or for pitchers.
In a big moment in this game, here you go. Your Nunez making mistakes. Sanchez picks him off in second base with Benintendi up, guy in scoring position, two outs in the fifth inning. This was a close game at the time, and you get picked off second base. Huge, huge play in the game.
Place went nuts. I mean, the stadium erupted when that happened as well. And I think the fact that you see Nunez over there flopping around, and it makes it that much better too. Just for whatever reason, you know, a little bit of a shot, but
it's like an ex-girlfriend, even one you didn't even really like. You just don't want to see them succeed after you break up with them.
Yeah. I mean, and Nunez was like, I think a lot of people thought he was going to be much better than he was, and he was going to be the heir apparent, you know, at some point.
He's been much better elsewhere than with
it's
the Yankees.
True. Well, he always could hit. I mean, he always hit. He hit with the Yankees too.
He had a really good, if you look at his stats, he had a really good season in Minnesota and a really good season in San Francisco.
Yeah. And he's getting opportunities to play a lot more often now too. I think that's probably helping him. He's still not great in the field, and he can't run the bases. So it is what it is. I think he is pretty much the player we thought he was. He's just getting more time and hitting more. But it was a big play. Sanchez has been playing freaking out of his mind, honestly, this year. I mean, such an improvement, I think, defensively. I'm not seeing him as a problem behind the plate at all anymore. Like, yes, there are some times when he's, you know, you don't see the blocking like you would, but who gives a shit when you're seeing the way that the clip that he could throw out guys at and hold people. It's not even so much the throwing out the people, it's holding them in position, because that's a big thing. Even if he doesn't throw out the amount of guys that you see, you know, tops in the American League or whatever, you're seeing the influence on the runners, on the opposing team, for what is possible with him, with that cannon of an arm. And he just looks like he's stronger, in better shape. He's mashing the ball. he might be you know, one of the best, if not the best player in the American League right now.
He's leading the American League in home runs with 18. That ties his total from last year.
Yeah, love that.
And we're at the beginning of June. His he had a couple throwing errors early in the season. Remember those? He threw a couple balls into center field. And it's one of those things with his arm, you don't want him to lose confidence in. And I'm not suggesting he is, because that is the best part of his catching game, is his arm and his willingness to throw down to second base in a key situation and pick a guy off. Not many catchers have the balls to do that.
Oh, he is not gun shy by any means. He doesn't give a fuck. He's sitting there and ready to. He's like a Molina brother, but he'll snap at you at any second. He's got that like, yeah, that influence.
Always got to be on your instinct. Toes on the base paths, because you never know where the ball's going to go. And yeah, he's not going to be Austin Romine blocking the ball. He's not going to be. He's. But as long as he's competent, as long as it's not getting in his own head, and then we're sitting there, and a pitcher has to second guess a pitch selection in a key spot, because that's really where it comes in and can hurt the team, is if Adam Ottavino is afraid to throw his slider with a guy on third base and in a big situation in the eighth inning.
And we've seen that in the past. I mean, I do feel like David Robertson in the past throwing in the eighth inning has, you know, thought twice about burying one of his, you know, breaking balls, you know, just beyond the plate because of who's back there. And that's just not a thought in my head anymore. I mean, he just looks like, first of all, if anybody thinks that, if anybody doesn't think that last year was just a weird year, that was an outlier, that he was probably still nagging injuries, just a lot of weird things happened to him last year. Like, it's a throwout year for me, because we're seeing what he is at the plate now, and it's exactly what we thought he was from the beginning he ever stepped foot as a New York Yankee. Like, the guy is the home run that he hit on Saturday, opposite field, end of the bat, was just all brute strength. It was just flip the wrist, get the bat on ball, doing amazing things, and the ball travels 400 freaking feet
into the bullpen. It was a pitch outside, a slider out,
low and away.
Look, it's like he's off balance. It's a weird swing. That's a fly ball 20 feet in front of the warning track for any other player.
Yes. And he's got so much power that he just needs to get the bat on the ball. And we could say that about a bunch of guys on this team. But when you're also the starting catcher who's, you know, to me, improved, and now you're also, because of that improvement, I think that certainly helps the level of confidence that he has at the plate as well. He's just a confident guy, man. And even late in the game, I think it was the eighth or ninth inning last night, when there was a ball that was outside the zone that was called a strike, and he was visibly mad that he didn't
get the inning of a game that the scoreboard might say that doesn't really matter. But yeah.
I love that. I love that. Seeing that type of thing. I mean, like, if anybody listens to the show for a while, you know that I like visible emotion, you know, whether it's good or bad.
Always love it out of your catcher, because the catcher can get a pitcher in trouble.
Give a shit. And at that point in the game,
I know he wasn't behind the plate last night, but
at that point in the game, like, you know, he knows the strike zone, he knows the situation, he knows everything about it, he knows the you know, how important that pitch was, because I think it was a 2-0 count at that point. And was it Workman or it might have been whoever was pitching in the eighth inning,
Barnes.
Yeah, it might have been Barnes. He couldn't find the strike zone. So the fact that he's getting a pitch like that's, you know, 2 to 3 inches outside the zone was just irritating. So I just like seeing that visible emotion. For as a fan, when I'm watching my players, I want to see that. I want to see frustration if you're doing poorly. I want to see visible happiness if you're doing well. Like, I love that, and I kind of feed off of it, and I think a lot of other fans do. So I don't know. When you see little things like that, you're just like, it's just good to see.
The number one thing we want to see
we want you to care.
Fans is we want the players to care as much as we care.
Right.
Which is crazy to say. I understand the lunacy of that statement, because of course they care more. They're in there every day.
They're caring in different
ways.
But
we're psychotic about it. We get emotional. There's no, when you're a fan, when you're a diehard fan, rationality goes out the window. In certain situations.
In certain situations, you're a lunatic. You're a lunatic and you lose your mind. It doesn't matter if you're 12 years old or if you're 60 years old. You lose your mind. It's one of those things that takes over your body. And I can't help it. Like, I physically can't help it when something happens like that. And I don't know when it's going to be. It just happens. And then And then, you know, my body tells you it happens.
Right, because we can sit here sometimes the day after a game or if the game happened a few days ago and we can talk about it rationally. But in the moment, I'm not that rational.
During playoff games, I can't even sit down. I can't talk to people. If you're talking to me in a playoff game, I'm like, I don't want to talk to you. I'm standing there. I'm like just in every single pitch. So yeah, it's we're crazy lunatics, all of us.
I want to talk about Herman in a second, but the Yankees bullpen had to really win the game on Saturday. They went to Green, Canley, Ottavino, Holder, who had a really big outing for them, Britton, and then Chapman. Yankees bullpen ranks number one in baseball for WAR already, 4.1. Tampa's at two at 2.6, so they've got a big lead in bullpen WAR, which is pretty crazy. First in strikeouts per nine innings, third in ERA, second in FIP, fourth in expected FIP. This is all without Dellin Betances.
Yeah, I mean, when John Blair wrote that article about Yankees Tampa when we went to the Trop the last time, and I had him on, we were comparing some of the stats for the bullpens as well, and a lot of the pitching stats, and ironically, like surprisingly, some of the offensive stats were very close. So Tampa and the Yankees were pretty close to the top of the team stats when you're looking at the bullpens as well. And you're seeing they're really good as well. They're not using it as much, but the Yankees have a unit back there, man. And the fact that Betances isn't even there yet. Again, we've talked about this. You got to tip your hat. And the fact that we're seeing Tommy Canley back to the guy that we thought we acquired when he came over from the White Sox is huge.
Been great.
It's huge.
He's been an animal out there.
I mean,
tweeted me Psycho Tommy. That's his nickname.
He's a psycho. He's crazy too. I love it. I mean, you see that with his fandom of the. I mean, people don't like the Eagles, but I appreciate the fact and how diehard he is and how obsessive he is. You see what kind of an emotional guy he is. You know, when you're looking at how big of a fan he is in other sports too. So, but yeah, I mean, he's essentially stepped in for Betances and really not dropped anything off.
This is another thing I've been trying to pinpoint. I was talking about this with Frank, actually. Chad Green's arm angle, just from the naked eye, looks a little lower. Like he's a little bit more three quarters in his recent outings when he's been much, much better. And if we were looking at Brooks Baseball, some charts on there. And when you compare the vertical arm slot and the horizontal arm slot, yes, it is slightly lower. I don't know. Maybe the Yankees would say that's just margin of difference that it hasn't really changed. But his starts or his appearances early in the season, when you look at the chart, are at the high end, and then now they're at the lower end in his recent games. So maybe some of those mechanics he was talking about that he was trying to fix in the minors was also an arm slot thing. And we've seen Chad Green. I don't know if anyone fully trusts Chad Green at this point yet. But he's starting to build that trust back up because he's having more good appearances.
Yeah, they were talking about it on the broadcast. I think it was on Saturday when they were talking about Chad Green about the late action on the fastball, and that's to me one of the biggest things for him. He's a fastball command pitcher. If he can command that fastball and he throws it 90, 98, 99, and he could throw triple digits if he needs to. He's the guy that gets it up there, but he's got that late action on the fastball. And if he doesn't have that late action, you're seeing more of a flat fastball that's more hittable. But it seems like he's starting to get that back. And it does make sense. If you're throwing it more of a three-quarter slot or a little bit different arm angle, you're probably going to get some more action on it. Whereas you're coming over top, it's going to be more of a flat fastball. You can definitely get more on it when you're coming in at a three-quarter angle. And you know, I think one of the big things that he did change was was where he broke his hands.
That was what they talked about, where his hand placement before the pitch.
But that has that also can have a very direct result in where you release the ball too, because if you think about it, if you start your hands up higher, you're not trying to compensate and get your arm back into a slot that needs to be. So it's possible when he was breaking lower that he was overcompensating and his arm was going at a different slot that normally would be, whereas, you know, now he's a little higher and the muscle memory is just keeping him in that same almost a parallel zone. It's helping him. But either way, you want to see the movement on the fastball. You want to see the command on the fastball, but you really want to see the confidence building in his head and the fact that he knows he can throw that, because that's what it comes down to. If he knows he can throw it, you know, that's a much bigger difference than a guy that has zero confidence out there and looks lost.
Because he's going to be an 80% of the time fastball pitcher. That's how he needs to succeed.
Right.
So if he doesn't have his fastball, he's shit out of luck.
Yeah, and he needs to believe in the fact that he has that fastball.
Right. Hey, do you guys ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. Well, with millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. You can search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. Maybe you're looking to go to the next Yankees homestand. The Yankees are going on the road. They're going to be playing up in Toronto. Maybe you want to go see the Yankees beat the Blue Jays up in Toronto. Who knows? Stanley Cup Finals, NBA Finals. Maybe you're looking to drop like $2,000 on a ticket. Do it on SeatGeek. You and I have used it plenty of times. We've talked about this. My favorite thing is the app, the app experience. I think that's so huge when you're shopping for tickets. They make it easy. They color code them green, yellow, and red. You're looking for those green deals, whether you're looking for the for just a cheap ticket you want to get in the stadium, or you're looking for a really good seat. If you're looking for a green deal, that's the way to go. And if you just look at their app store, they have over 50,000 five-star reviews. That's how you know they have good customer satisfaction, Scott.
When you're looking at what they do, I think one of the biggest things, if you listen to to Michael Kay, I mean, Michael Kay has been ripped off of tickets in the past. He's bought bogus, fraudulent tickets. Well, that's not a thing with SeatGeek. They are fully guaranteed, so you can shop with confidence. I do have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's by far the fastest and the easiest way to buy tickets. I told you guys in the past, I've bought them for football. I have bought Yankee tickets with there. I've bought in Springsteen. Springsteen's got a new album coming out, so that means he's probably going to tour. Unfortunately, it most likely won't be with the E Street Band. He'll probably do a solo tour. Nonetheless, you got to see him. The storytelling will be unbelievable. I'm sure the music will be phenomenal again, too. I'm a big Springsteen guy. But SeatGeek, even when you're looking for a new one, if you have never used the app before, SeatGeek will give you $10 off your very first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code Bronx. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code Bronx to get $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code Bronx for $10 off your first purchase.
One thing I think we're starting to see is Herman hit a wall. So 3 2/3 against the Red Sox over the weekend. We saw the classic Herman, 21 swings and misses in it, but it was 87 pitches in those 3 2/3 innings. And he has been so good. He has been their best starting pitcher. He has really allowed Severino to take his time getting back, which you cannot understate how valuable that has been to the team. But this is also a guy who pitched, it was like, what did we say, 90 innings. I forget the exact number last year. His career high came 5 years ago in the minors for innings. So his workload has been a lot this year, and I think we're starting to see some effects on that.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing about Herman is I'm not taking anything away from what he's done, but even though some of his last good starts too, he's had a lot of base runners on, and there's been an element of him getting out of situations that that could have gone very bad. And I think what we're seeing now is him not getting out of these situations when these runners are on, he's always had the swing and miss, but he's still, even if he's not walking guys at a higher rate, or at least not in the early in the season, he wasn't, you still saw base hits. You still saw, traffic on the base path, and he was getting out of these innings. And you especially saw it in the fourth, fifth innings, later when he's going around for that third time. We've seen the stats on his third time through the lineup. They're significantly worse than the first two. I mean, it's probably the case with most starting pitchers, but
yeah,
there's a significant difference between that. And you see the traffic on the base path, with that third time around, fifth, sixth inning.
It was a lot of deep counts. It just takes a lot of pitches.
Yeah. Well, and the swing and miss stuff, it just isn't probably as sharp at that point as well. And obviously they have a better visual on what the pitcher's throwing, what the pitch is going to do. So the pitcher's always at a disadvantage when you're going and facing a guy a second, third, fourth time through the lineup. I mean, that's unless you're throwing you're on your best day, and you're just filthy and hitting on throwing unhittable stuff, the batter's going to have another advantage because they've seen what you can do.
His previous start was against Kansas City, by far the worst start of his season. He gave up 4 home runs, 7 runs. And then the time before that was a so-so outing against Baltimore. 5 innings, 3 runs. The Yankees pulled him because they had a huge lead. But I think the discussions are starting that how are they going to start to manage his workload? Are they going to just use him as an opener going forward? I know Dallas Dallas Keuchel because the draft is this week. It starts on Monday after the Yankees don't have to lose their draft pick by signing Keuchel. Are they going to bring someone like that in to help manage his workload? If you add another starting pitcher, whether it's bringing back Severino or adding Dallas Keuchel, can you then maybe skip Herman a few times to give him a little bit extra rest, and that way you also manage his innings? I don't know what the right play is. Like, do you skip him every other time, or do you shut him down for a period of time to manage? Like, that I always struggle with. Like, what's better for the pitcher? What's better for the team?
Yeah. But I mean, if you shut him down, then he's got to ramp back up too and find all that stuff again. So
I almost feel like that's more risky. It seems like a lot more giving work. A guy basically like 9 days in between starts.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, one, I think the draft competition fell off yesterday, right? I think it fell off yesterday. So now, as of today or last night at some point, maybe midnight, Kimbrel and Keuchel no longer are. I think it's the week of the draft it kicks off. Either way, it's not going to be a consideration for the draft pick. But yeah, it depends on what happens, because right now we're looking at the depth. Yes, Paxton is back. We're hoping that we can get Severino back at some point. But you're looking at the options, and there just aren't great options to skip starts as well. So you're looking
not
at
now. No.
No, not right now. So you're in a position where you can't get too cute with that rotation until you have bodies fully back. You see that Paxton's, back throwing 100 pitches again or right around there. You want to see a lot of these things. Severino coming back and getting back into the rotation, which I don't even know if they can honestly wait for that point. They probably have to make
that's
a move.
That's actually probably too far away.
Yeah, so I think all eyes right now are who gets Keuchel. Are the Yankees actually in on Keuchel? There was a picture of Dallas Keuchel without a beard. I had no idea who the guy was. I didn't believe that it was Dallas Keuchel. He looked like a completely different person.
Well, Heyman tweeted out, Yankees say Keuchel would have to shave his signature beard if he signs with them. And he, Keuchel, has said he's willing to do that. However, the Yankees considered favorites to sign him with the Braves and Cardinals. As of early today, still were thought to be apart on money. So I guess they're haggling over the price. I don't know why. I've seen
little driplets of information. I don't know how accurate it is, but something I saw. I don't even remember the hell I saw. It was last week at some point that he's looking for 17 for the rest of the year.
Okay, and you know what? I kind of understand his point of view on that. But here's the thing: whether he signs for 7 or 17, the Yankees are going to be over that next threshold. So what the hell is the difference?
Well, that's the thing. Are they willing to go over that threshold? If they are, then who cares, right? Exactly.
If you sign him, you're going to be over because you're.
Oh yeah, I know.
But that's right up against that right now.
But that's what it is. Like, I think the Yankees and the Red Sox are in a similar position. Is who's going to, if one of you are going to spend the money, is the other one going to do it now too? Or are they both waiting to see who blinks first? And is that Dallas Keuchel or Craig Kimbrel? Are they playing a game of Russian roulette and tricking?
If we're playing Russian roulette with the Red Sox over spending money,
it's not even spending money. It's adding the player, which is essentially spending money. But they're both up against tax thresholds that are putting them in a similar position. It's just
this is pissing me off. This is pissing me off because we said, I don't care if you don't sign Manny Machado or Bryce Harper if you want to take the team in a different direction, but put the best team on the field. We have gotten shit for supporting, quote unquote, the team to get under the tax threshold in previous years because everyone, we thought, okay, we're going to gear up. Let's go. Let's go on this 2019 free agent class. And they still spent money in this offseason. Britton, Happ, LeMahieu were all signed as free agents. So fine, that's great. But if a next tax threshold, which could potentially put you over the top for a World Series run, is going to stop you from signing Dallas Keuchel, that is when I get pissed off as a fan.
I saw JJ tweet this out, or might have been Keith. I don't know. I think it came from the George's Box Twitter account. I don't remember. But I like it. I like it a lot. And I think this is exactly how it needs to happen. And I know it's not the same situation because there one was a comeback from a player that had already been here, and this would be different. But I think it could have a very similar feeling, because Dallas Keuchel has been a Yankee killer, right? He's been a Yankee killer, notorious, been a Yankee killer. He's single-handedly knocked us out of the playoffs in the past. But if they sign Dallas Keuchel, and he shows up in Cashman's box without a beard. And Susan Waldman loses her shit about Dallas Keuchel coming back. And now he's once a Yankee killer, but now is going to help the Yankees chase number 28 in the middle of a big homestand, a night game, maybe on June 22nd against the Houston Astros. I don't know. I kind of like that. I feel like we would build it off. I like the narrative. I like the fact that he would then throw it in the Astros' face. And then he would make this big announcement coming off the box. I think this is the perfect way. I'm pretty sure I've just laid out the perfect scenario for Dallas Keuchel and the New York Yankees to how they need to approach this signing and get it done.
They could do like an unveil. He could wear a fake beard and like so
no,
everyone.
I don't even want that. This is all I want. I want him to come out there. I want him to do the Roger Clemens with his hands out. I want him to like just
rip
like,
the beard, my rip people, the fake beard off, and look, I'm shaved.
These are my
extra
people.
Ugly now.
No, I want him to be like the guy that nobody even knows who the hell he is. Like, who is this? Who is this guy?
Oh, no, they'll recognize him.
They will recognize him with the beard, though. But if he comes out without a beard, who is this guy? Why are we making a big deal of this guy? And Susan Waldman's like, oh my God, wait a minute. Who is it? It's there's no beard. Oh my goodness. It's Dallas Keuchel. And, you know, notorious Yankee killer now going to help the Yankees go for number 28 and lose her complete everlasting mind. And John just sitting there like staring at his work wife.
His flip phone. He had a flip phone.
Yeah.
He was talking to Dallas Keuchel's people on his flip phone over the weekend.
Look, I'm telling you, this is a beautiful situation, a beautiful scenario. The timing is kind of working out. I feel like it could actually work out pretty well as far as timing. You could even do it where he pitches on Sunday. Like, let's... TBD pitcher on Sunday.
He's gonna come back and pitch against the Astros.
I mean, why not?
Cashman's box on Saturday.
Yeah, let's do
Yankee Stadium mound on Sunday.
You got plenty of time now to get the signing done in hush hush. He's ready to go. Sunday is a TBD guy. All of a sudden, Dallas Keuchel pops out. Cashman's box. Boom! Announce him as the starter on Sunday. Closes the series out with a sweep. And we now
head off to London.
And we go to London. Because you know he wants to be in London.
Yeah. I think...
Who doesn't?
Listen. The rotation needs help in some way. And he is the clearest option for help right now. That's only going to cost you money. You can go out and trade for somebody, but that might be too costly as far as young players go. So if it's only going to cost you money and we're talking about a tax threshold, just do it. Pony up and do it. If it's going to help you get through the rest of the season and into October.
To be very clear, I don't care about the money. I don't care about the Yankees'
money.
None of us
really care about the money until it stops the team from doing something.
Correct.
I understood. I tried to put myself in a perspective of I'm running the team. What is the best way to run this team so I can have success in the future? And that was to get under the tax threshold last year.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm more talking about the fact that I think you and I have both supported the fact that Cashman and ownership has managed the roster and the money to get under that threat. It just makes sense. It's money that could be spent on a player afterwards that was literally just getting thrown away and actually given to other teams essentially to make them better. So why are you going to do that? Why are you going to give them more of a competitive advantage by giving them adding more money to this pool that then gets distributed when you can manage it, still have a very good team on the field and not have to do that? And I think that's what's happening right now. The fact that they've already gotten under it, now they are out of the penalty. They're going to go back over it at some point. So who cares when it is? Let's just get this team to the promised land. It's been 10 years. We're ready to go.
I mean, the reality is they could be over it even if they don't sign Keuchel. That's how close they are to it. Because a lot of different factors are you got something?
Yeah. Well, it's nothing breaking, but I was looking up because I hadn't looked to see what he was doing lately, what Gio Gonzalez was doing, you know? Because I think that's a lot of people are thinking, well, we had Gio Gonzalez. He started off really well with the Milwaukee Brewers. He is now on the 10-day injured list with a dead arm. So that's where he is. But he was pitching to a 2-1, 3.19 ERA. I don't have
the advanced metrics. And he would have put you over because if he had made the majors, he gets a $3 million basically roster bonus for making the major league roster. And then what was it? 500K for every start he makes in the majors.
Yeah. It was, as soon as he's called up, you're over.
Yeah.
So do you want Gio Gonzalez or do you want Dallas Keuchel at that point?
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Because you're over. Who cares? Who cares how much you're over? You're over.
Once you're over, the tax is the next. Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Sabathia was pretty good, actually, returned from the injured list. Struck out 8 guys in 6 innings, 3 runs, the 2 home runs. The first, I didn't even think they were terrible pitches. Kind of an inside cutter that JD Martinez just got to. And then I think it was a slider. Kind of low in the zone to Bogarts. They hit, I thought, 2 okay pitches.
I'm not even worried about it. The fact, like, the ball's going to fly out occasionally with him. But I thought what we saw is even after he ran to first base on a ball that I was surprised he even tried to run to first base when Luke Voit was...
He doesn't do that anymore.
Huh? But he did.
He doesn't do that anymore.
But he motored there. He was getting close. I mean, I think the runner was beating him.
That knee must be feeling really good.
Yeah, well, he started limping afterwards. So, but the fact that he was limping and then pitched, I don't know, 2-3 more innings after that was a good sign, I guess. But he looked good. He threw... 6 innings. I think he got 8 strikeouts. So, I mean, he was getting swings and misses. Yeah, he left some balls where the Red Sox could get to them. But overall, I thought it was a positive performance for sure.
The big thing is, though, Clint Frazier, and it's just another terrible night in right field. Probably the worst night he's had in right field. And he's had some bad ones. And
it's probably one of the worst nights I've ever seen defensively. For real.
I think actually A-Rod said he played three singles into 2 triples and a double.
I don't remember that. What I'm doing is going off my memory of what I remember. and this is what I remember. How many times am I going to say remember? But Clint Frazier was absolutely abysmal. I mean, I was thinking of Chuck Knoblauch when I was watching it. That's what I was thinking of.
He has the fielding equivalent of the throwing yips.
I mean, like, not even going to the right places. It looked like he didn't even see things. So, yeah.
The one in the, what was it, the eighth inning with the just pop fly down the right field line.
Yes.
Which I think Judge just catches, never mind, just has it into a single.
Judge catches it in like 3 strides.
Frazier ran to a spot where the ball was not.
Right.
And then the ball takes a kick to the right field corner. People were saying, oh, he didn't judge the spin on the ball, but he wasn't in the right spot for the ball where it was going
to
land.
He overran the ball. The ball landed almost like next to him. So he wasn't even going to the right spot. It's like I don't know if he's concerned when he's getting that close to the line that he's looking down to see where the wall is and then looking up and then like losing the ball. He doesn't look comfortable out there. He doesn't look like he is, honestly, if I'm being honest with the preparation of, like, I know he's been talking about, putting all this extra work in, but it doesn't seem like he's familiar and comfortable with the field and where things are. We saw that in Kansas City. He certainly didn't look comfortable knowing where he was in right field. That's understandable. He's on the road. But Yankee Stadium, you know, even if you're not a right fielder by trade or you're not over there all the time, he's played there enough where he should absolutely know that stadium well.
Mm-hmm. Potentially the worst thing was that he didn't talk to the reporters after the game. There was finally a report at 2 a.m. So from Coley Harvey, who must have texted Frazier late night and got a response.
Or Frazier just finally returned his text at 2 a.m.
I've been working really hard every day with outfield coach Reggie Willis before batting practice starts. And despite what has been happening during the game, I'm still confident in myself to be able to turn this around soon. It's tough to cost the team runs and a potential win, especially when playing at home against Boston, things keep happening that shouldn't. And I'm acknowledging that with all of the early work I'm doing, before games. Standard cliche response. Hey, I'm putting in the work. I'm trying to get better out there. And hold on. That's good. That's fine. But you say that immediately after the game. You stand there and you stand at your locker and you be accountable. I think Hoke tweeted out that one thing that the Yankees teach in spring training is you be accountable. You're going to mess up. It's going to happen. You're going to strike out a lot in big you're going to strike out in big situations. You're going to make fielding errors. You're going to give up home runs if you're a pitcher. Like, all that stuff is known when you're a baseball player.
If you get out 2 of 3 times, you're a Hall of Famer.
Don't hide from the media. That's only going to make it worse. You stand there and say, I was bad tonight. I will be better next time. People put it to rest and we move on. How hard is that to understand?
So I think that we're playing first of all, It was a bad move. It was a bad, bad move. And I kind of love the condescending tweet from Brian Hoke and the fact that this is what they were taught, and the fact that he walked away. Like, let me tell you up front what they teach first. The Derek Jeter School of Talking to the Media says you be accountable for what you do. And no matter if it's good or bad, you talk to the media because they have a job to do. It's their job to get your answers and then write about it. If they don't get your answers, they won't have to go to other players, or they have to, you know, get in your mind and put out things that you probably don't want to be put out there. Right. You controlling the narrative is you standing in front of that locker and being accountable. That's another part of it. But the fact that you're not allowing these guys to do their job is a problem, and it pisses them off. I'm sure it pisses them off because they work stupid hours. They're all tired. They're all away from their families.
Oh, no. See, I disagree.
And they want to see it. They want to see the things.
Them being able to tweet that he left, that gets the beat reporters more attention.
I mean, it gets them more attention, fine, but it doesn't make their job easier. It makes their job, now they have to speculate and they have to go around and get more quotes from different people to try to put together a puzzle. They always want the soundbite from the player, always. Because what you would have gotten...
We know what the soundbite is. I could have told you
Cliff
Frazier's response without even seeing his response. That's a standard response. I'm working out there every day. We see the videos before the game of Clint Frazier taking fly balls in right field.
He's already said this. We knew that answer before he came out there or before he texted it, because he said it in the past. He said it on his last bad game.
Right.
I understand what you're saying, but hear me out. The fact that he left... We know what Clint Frazier is, right? He's a highly emotional guy that lets that get in his head. Right. I think he left because he couldn't control himself. He didn't know what he was going to say, and he left because he's like, and maybe this is his thinking, and I don't think it's better. I think it's still worse. I think you just need to be able to control yourself at this point. You're a professional athlete. It's part of your job to talk to the media, be a professional. But I think that he still got a lot of immaturity, and the fact that he left was because he was mad, couldn't control himself, and just decided to leave. And it was a bad decision. It was a rash decision, and he's probably going to pay for it because he's going to get these questions now for a long time. And the fact that he pissed them off, this is where it's going to bite him. He pissed them off by leaving because it made their job harder, and now they're going to continue to pepper him with questions. Now they don't give him the benefit of the doubt, and it's not like it's just that night where they're pissing them off. Now it's going to carry on, and it's in the back of their minds and lingering. So they're not going to give him the softballs when he has a bad day. They're going to come at him, and it's going to be worse.
I think we agree on the end result that now he's got a tougher time with the media, but I disagree with you that it's because that Clint Frazier pissed off these beat reporters. It's just now they have to ask the question because this is what people are going to care about. This is what people want to talk about is Clint Frazier going to speak to the media after games? Now this is the thing. Clint Frazier walking out of Yankees clubhouse last night and not answering questions has made, is Clint Frazier going to avoid the media a thing now? So good job, Clint.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if he avoids it again after avoiding it the first time, knowing what the backlash is, then it's blatant stupidity and insanity because
he wants to endear himself to fans. I think it's very obvious with all the cleat stuff he's doing. He wants to be a celebrity in addition to a baseball player. And I, on the surface of that, have no problem with it. As long as you're performing on the field, if you want to embrace your fame and connect with the fans to market yourself better, to have more fun, to be more popular, to sell more jerseys, whatever it is, fine. That's the opportunity you have out there. Some guys just want to go out there and treat it like a 9-to-5 job and put their head down and just sign their contract and be done with it. I respect that as well. But that is not what Clint Frazier seems to want to do. He wants to be the most popular guy on the team. He's not going to be.
I mean, he'll never be that guy. But
he wants to be popular. He changed his number to 77 because Aaron Judge had number 99.
He was trying to troll Mickey Mantle and Susan Waldman, apparently.
Well, right. But he's tweeting about all these cleats that he's doing. He's asking for nicknames, right? Like he's trying hard. And
okay, so some of these things are leftover narratives. Like the whole nickname thing was definitely something that happened.
I don't care if he does this stuff. Right. As long as he catches the ball in right field, I don't care. When you don't catch the ball in right field and then you leave the clubhouse and don't answer the questions, you got a big problem, dude. Not going to work. It's not going to work if he's going to, if this is what's going to happen. I don't care how many freaking home runs he hits.
I have zero problem with him doing any of that stuff off the field. Like, I think it's just adding to his, he's just being himself in the sense that he likes fashion and he's doing these cool things. I think it's cool what he's doing with the
1,000%
with the shoes. Like, I think it's, it doesn't, I don't think that has anything to do with what he's doing on the field. I think the fact is that sometimes he's got a maturity problem dealing with pressures of the struggle and the fact that when you have one struggle, it can platoon into other things. And to his credit, he did come back the next inning and got a base hit in a situation that he needed to get on base and put the Yankees in a position where they could do damage in the eighth inning and possibly put more runs on the board. So to his credit, he didn't let it affect him. He had a good at bat, but in the outfield, he looks lost. And who knows? I mean, are there things that have happened with this concussion thing that are lingering in the outfield where he's not as comfortable, where he's being a little bit hesitant in the way that he goes after balls that's just affecting the way he does? It's very possible. I don't know. I can't get in his head. I can't understand
what that's what we said. Is that why he's gun shy going into the right field corner and up against the wall? And that's also a very real issue that I understand. But the warning track is there so you know how many steps you have before the wall. And
is that why it's called a warning track?
It is. Oh. And in Kansas City, if you remember that play into the right field corner, he fell down 7 feet from the right field wall because he thought he was going to hit it. So he didn't understand. Like, I know it's a visiting ballpark, but your job as an outfielder is to go out there and understand, okay, I have 10 steps after I hit the warning track. That's too many. Whatever. I have 3 strides after I hit the warning track before I hit the wall. No, this is what you're paid to do.
No, I get
this
it.
This is
I
what
mean,
you're paid to do as a baseball player. Your life is not that hard as a baseball player. Like, do that, dude.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying. Like, I at the same time, I also understand the fact that, you know, you're coming in at a different angle, at different speeds. It's not like you could really project how many strides you have once you hit the track, depending on where you come from. But you should be familiar with it. The fact that you're at a visiting ballpark, it's a tough outfield in the first place. I get that a little bit. So I'm not killing him for that one. The fact that you're at Yankee Stadium and you're
not talking about Fenway Park right field corner here.
I mean, like, it's a big stadium. It's a big outfield.
There's no corners. There's no triangles.
So you're still running. I'm like, why am I
monster?
Still running and not up against a wall? It doesn't feel right that I'm still running and I'm not up against a wall. I kind of understand it. Again, I'm not whatever. The use Yankee Stadium because that's to me. We just saw the worst night from a right fielder that I have seen probably ever. And it was at Yankee Stadium.
But he couldn't
feel
it. One of them was, that's basically a line drive, like ground ball that he
misplays.
Misplayed boots and it goes to the wall.
He didn't even boot it. Another just one. Didn't even touch him.
There's another one where it's a bad break on a ball and he dives and that doesn't work out. Like, don't dive when you know you're not going to catch it. Just play the ball in a hop and get the ball in. And then the pop fly friggin'
eighth
inning thing.
He's not seeing the ball well because the first step is bad. The other night when he had a bad first step, a bad play on the ball, a bad throw, and he even came up and threw the ball wild as hell when he after the dive last night too in the seventh. Yeah. You know, it's just overall like he's not seeing the ball well. He's in his own head. The first step is terrible. You knew he was going to dive at the ball after the errors that he made. He was trying to make a to save himself, even though he had a bad jump on the ball in the first place. His first step was back. Whatever. We could kill him for a long time on this. The fact is that I think he's got the ability. He's certainly got the athleticism to play the outfield. We didn't see this guy, 2 years ago when he was playing the outfield, in left field. So is this a situation now where he can only play left field and that's it? And he just needs to play one position and just know that position. And he's limited in the sense that he cannot be flexible in the outfield. That's unfortunate. But maybe that's him. I don't know. He can be better. There's no doubt.
I want to run through a couple quick injury updates. Didi, so we thought maybe he'll be back for the Toronto series. It's now probably looking more like later in the week. Boone said June 7th against Cleveland is more realistic. Who knows, though? Didi could push his way on.
I can't believe he's taking this long.
Severino played catch on flat ground again on Friday, so he's still far away. Betances threw breaking balls in the bullpen. That's the first time he did that, and he said he felt good. Good news there. Judge taking fly balls, swinging off a tee. He's going to Tampa for rehab soon, so we could see him maybe end of June, early July, I think is probably realistic. Stanton also going back to Tampa to start a rehab. And then I got a couple fun ones. Troy Tulowitzki is, quote, pretty much over the injury. Okay. Greg Bird is heading to Tampa to start the next stages of his rehab. My question to you is, do we care?
No, I really don't think we care. I mean, I don't know how Scranton's doing at first base right now, but maybe he could help them out. And,
well, I don't think he's going to McBroomy? Get Mike Ford out of the lineup.
Mike Ford and McBroomy are two guys you got to get in there now against. I don't care about Bird. If he's back and swinging the bat, I mean, that's good. Just give us some more depth. Like, that's what he is at this point. He's a depth piece, maybe, which is ironic as shit because he's never
healthy.
There's
no way that he gets his way onto this team unless there's somehow more injuries.
No, that's why I said depth piece. He's got to be healthy in AAA, and there has to be an opportunity that opens up. Yes. But it's good.
Luke Voit has to get hurt.
Yeah. Right. Depth.
And if he does, I'm just saying, what did Greg Bird do? Did he have a voodoo cat on him or something? Like,
if Voit gets hurt? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Probably. I love the fact that Judge is coming back. It seems like for all accounts, he seems like he's over the oblique injury. That's what it seems like, at least. He's been taking, dry swings. Now we're going a little wetter swings, a little more wet damp. Off of the tee. They're damp swings, moist swings, if you will.
Yeah. Some people don't like that word.
They hate it. They hate it. But it's good
Doesn't
to see. And he's going to be back for the London series again, like probably they all will be.
Going to Toronto for the first time, we kind of mentioned that the Yankees have not played Toronto. We crap on Baltimore. Everyone craps on Baltimore. Toronto's like barely ahead of them in the standings. So this is another bad team that you got to beat up on.
The difference with the two is that the Blue Jays have names in their rotation that wouldn't surprise you if they came out and threw well and could shut you down.
You still got to beat the Blue Jays.
You still got to beat the Blue Jays. It's just more fun shitting on the Orioles just because.
because they're more laughably bad than the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
But let's not treat the Blue Jays. Let's not go lose a series to the Blue Jays and say, well, it's tough to play in Toronto. No.
No. They should beat the Blue Jays. That's absolutely the case. They need to beat up on the Blue Jays. They need to beat up on the Orioles, take care of that business.
Because guess what? You got 19 games from this point on against the Blue Jays. You can't start losing games to the Blue Jays.
We're not. Don't worry. It hasn't happened yet. Relax.
You got a prediction for the Blue Jays record?
No, I don't. I am good with my predictions right now. I'm holding steady.
Yeah. Let's get to mailbags. If you guys want to submit mailbag questions, a couple ways to do it. You can submit an email at bronxpinstripes.com/podcast. You can tweet us at Yankees Podcast, or you can join the Facebook group, The Bronx Pinstripe Show. And that's where the first one from Ken Sunderson comes from. Is anyone else kind of finished with Kendrys Morales experiment? I don't really see much. Is it only because he's a lefty? Why not play LeMahieu at first and keep Urshela, Estrada, and Torres in the lineup if Voit needs a night off? And I think this is going to really come to a head when Didi comes back. We touched on this last episode. We theorized that it might be Estrada because Estrada has options. But if I'm the GM, I'm releasing Morales. But I was trying to say, what is Cashman going to do? And I think we're going to see Estrada go down.
I think they are going to play with some options here because, once you release a guy, obviously that's it. And they like the flexibility. And the fact is that if you have a guy that's not playing very often anymore, especially if Didi were to come back, then yeah, there's flexibility there because Estrada does have options. You could bring him back up. Whereas if you get rid of Morales, and I still think they kind of like him being on the team, then that's it. That experiment is over. I thought it was hilarious last night. First of all, I cannot watch or listen and watch a game on Sunday night without just like ripping apart A-Rod every, I can't help myself. It's like I have to, I don't even know. Nobody else gets me like that, but it drives me nuts. But the fact that he's talking about Morales bunting it was the ninth inning. I don't disagree with what he was saying. It's just funny that he says it.
You just hate the guy that's saying the words.
A-Rod would not bunt in that situation. Not in a million years. So the fact that he's saying it and saying that it's like the team thing to do, that it's unbelievable that he wouldn't do it, it's just, it's laughable to me because you would never see Alex Rodriguez bunt in that situation. Anyway, whatever.
You realize you're talking shit about the next Yankee manager.
Kendrys Morales has not been good.
Yankee manager.
He started out, you know, decent, got an early home run, and that was it. He's been bad. He's been bad ever since, and he's not a good team. He's not a good player on this team, but the fact is that he's a veteran, can play some first base, go out and DH a little bit. They like that.
What is the best Yankees defense when Didi's back? Infield.
The what best defense. Wow. That's going to leave Gleyber Torres off the field, I think. I think it's Didi at short. I think it's LeMahieu at second, Urshela at third. Yeah.
And Boyd at first. Yeah.
I take that back. If we're going completely best defense, then I would put like lockdown defense, then I'm LeMahieu at first, Gleyber at second.
That is completely wasting LeMahieu's defense.
Totally wasting it. I get it, but you asked me a question and I'm answering the question.
Okay. I actually disagree with that because LeMahieu is not a first baseman. He can play first base, but he's not a first baseman.
Bro, he's better than Lavoie at first base.
He's played a handful of games.
I don't give a shit. He could play the outfield better than most people probably.
Fine, but I just don't think you're going to get... and a lot of people are saying, okay, put LeMahieu at first, you get Gleyber second, Didi short, Urshela third, and you DH Luke Voit. And you'll see that sometimes, but I don't think that's going to be a regular everyday lineup. No. I think LeMahieu is going to be shifting from second to third, maybe one or two days at first base every now and again. You're going to get days off for Didi. You're going to get half days off for Didi because you don't want to rush him back too quickly. Glaber's still going to be filtering back and forth. There's going to be a rotation going on here. But I think if you're putting DJ LeMahieu at first base is a complete waste of his defense. He is such an elite second baseman. And he's a very good third baseman. That first base is like you're losing half the player. The reason we love DJ LeMahieu so much is, yes, he's a contact hitter. He's got great numbers with runners in scoring position, but he's also a lockdown defender. It's not that at first base.
I mean, he very well could be, but I understand what you're saying, and I was just playing contrarian in the sense that, like, if I'm looking at all hands team, then that's probably what it would be because I probably think that he could play a better first base. Look, I know everybody's like all over Luke Voit's nuts for his defense and the fact that he's like getting better. A lot of the plays that he's made, and this is not a popular opinion, a lot of the plays like this, the nice looking spectacular plays that he's made with the glove, are because his feet are freaking slow and he didn't get to the ball fast enough and he's making the glove ball. A lot of first basemen move their feet better and are in front of the balls that he's diving for. So, you know, take that with what you will, you know, for a grain of salt. I think he's playing good defense. I think he's fine. Improved. I'm not complaining about his defense. His
defense definitely improved.
I'm not complaining about his defense, but he's not a freaking gold glove guy over there by any means. That being said, you're having LeMahieu at second base or at third base. Like, yeah, he's in a better position. But I do think Gleyber could play a good second base. LeMahieu is a gold glove second baseman. Urshela is a gold glove caliber third baseman. Didi, gold glove caliber shortstop. So we're playing with a lot of options that are very good. And yes, there's going to be a rotation once this happens. And I think that's good for the team long term because, you know, with the shifting and these guys moving around, I think it's good that they're all playing different positions.
The next question is sort of on the same topic. So let me just read it from Chris Mack. Are you guys concerned that when Didi gets back and Gleyber moves back to second, that he, Gleyber, could struggle defensively?
No, I'm not really concerned about it. I mean, it could happen with a couple things here and there.
So advanced fielding metrics say that Gleyber is pretty much a league average second baseman and a league average shortstop.
Yeah.
He's got actually better.
You okay?
It's the effects of the weekend. It was a weekend, all right. He's got slightly better range at second base. So I think it's comparing to other second basemen. He's got better range at second base.
Because he's a shortstop.
But he's actually more instinctual at shortstop, and that's evident by the fact that he's actually plus one defensive run saved at shortstop. And he's minus one defensive run saved at second base.
Well, second base is a relatively new position to him in the sense that, you know, he's a natural shortstop. He's been playing shortstop. So you'd expect him to be, you know, more comfortable over in the, you know, in the sixth spot. But when you're looking at him as a second baseman, I always wanted him to stay at second base and wanted the Yankees to keep there so he could get comfortable there and more comfortable there. whatever. I'm beyond that at this point. Like, I think he's at a point where he's going to play. I think he's an average defender, and with the potential to be slightly above average. I think that's where he kind of slots in.
And his second part of the question, I know what you're going to answer. Name one former Yankee that you wish could have won a World Series with the team but didn't.
Yeah, this is an easy answer. It's Don Mattingly.
Oh, okay. I actually thought you were going to say Mike Mussina.
Why would I say Mike Mussina?
I forgot you love Don Mattingly. I forgot you're old.
Mike Mussina, I mean, for the large part of my youth was a Baltimore Oriole. So there was a not that I don't like him, because I do, but no, there's nothing there for that. It's 1,000% Don Mattingly.
No love for Chase Headley?
No, but you want to know what's funny, and I'm going to retweet this at some point. I did just find doing your Chase Headley dodgeball impression. The image, the picture of you as Chase Headley playing dodgeball from that horrible commercial 2 years ago.
I don't remember doing this.
Oh, nice. This will be good. Everybody look out for this tweet.
This is one of those things that, like, yeah, I put out so much Chase Headley hate back in the day that I don't really remember what I said.
You didn't say anything. It's an image. Oh,
there you go. Final question, Carol Morby. Why does Domingo Germán take his hat off and look inside before pitching? Just curious. It's not just Domingo Germán who does this. All pitchers are doing it on the team. They've got a little cheat sheet underneath the Bilba cap.
Yep. CC had one that got stuck to his head for a while. That was hilarious because he couldn't find it. And it was actually just like on his sweaty ass head. He was looking all on the ground. You see the outfielders doing it. They're looking at little cheat sheets that they have, where a certain guy is. They have little notes, whatever it is, probably little cliff notes on how to pitch.
The pitching ones are probably
signs.
Signs that they could also be data on the players they're facing.
I mean, that's a lot of things to have on a little thing. I think it's probably mostly the second set of signs that you're seeing for mostly pitchers. Or maybe just little reminders of what to do.
I think mechanical reminders could be.
Slot, keep your hands in this position, make sure you feel your right toe, like things like dumb shit like that, that they get in their heads to make sure that their body's going in the place that they want it to go. I think that's more, you outfielders, I think are literally telling you where guys hit.
I think O'Neill talked about this on the broadcast recently, that the whole outfield positioning has changed so much. But when he was playing, it was a coach saying two steps to the left, four steps in,
aircraft,
or something like that.
Air traffic controllers.
And now it's probably down to the exact inch on where you should play a guy.
Right. Yeah. No, there's probably Clint Frazier probably has the step count written on his hat because he does look at it each time.
Maybe they're giving him too much information. Maybe he's confused out there. Just go out and play baseball. Sometimes it's the best answer.
I think sometimes that's a real, real thing. Stop thinking.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, big thank you to everyone who came out over the weekend to the BP Crew event. Next one is right around the corner. Go get your tickets. They are a ton of fun. Scott, any last words?
Yeah, go get your tickets. We're going to see Dallas Keuchel.
Those were my last words.
Dallas Keuchel unveiled as the newest Yankees pitcher at the event. So that's exciting. That's another added value for your ticket. Go grab your tickets. Let's go, Yankees.
Go, Yankees. Kick the crap out of the Blue Jays. We'll talk to you Thursday.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.